Federal agents and local police conducted an armed raid on a farm cooperative in Venice, California last week, resulting in three arrests. Authorities seized $70,000 in raw organic food and poured an estimated 800 gallons of milk down the drain, but there was no evidence that any of the products were contaminated. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration joined forces with the FBI and local officials to bust Rossum, which is a private member raw food club. Rossum owner James Stewart and two farmers connected to the co-op were charged with 13 counts, including conspiracy to sell raw milk without a license. Unpasteurized products are legal in California, but the Los Angeles District Attorney says that applicable licenses and permits are required. But Rossum isn't exactly a grocery store. It doesn't sell to you, the general public. Instead, the facility is used to distribute food from local farms directly to its members. The FDA raid is said to protect your health. But is it? Up next, attorney Jonathan Emore joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Tonight, for the full program, you will hear Jonathan Emore. Jonathan, of course, a principal of Emore and Associates, practicing constitutional and administrative law. He has sued and defeated the FDA a number of times on amendment grounds. He'll be with us for the entire program tonight. He'll take your phone calls in the last hour of the program. Next hour, we'll talk with two consumer leaders who are very aware of what's going on as well. They'll join the conversation with Jonathan. And here he is, Jonathan Emore on Coast to Coast. How are you, my friend? What's new?
Great, George. Well, there's a lot going on out there with the FDA. And, of course, this whole budget deal is an absolute disaster. The nation's on the brink, George.
Holding on. You know, it's like holding onto the rope over the edge of a cliff, and you see parts of it starting to unwind.
You know, that's so true. A perfect metaphor. I'm afraid we really are going to slide into the abyss unless some very drastic measures are taken. And we have a choice. We can either hurt everybody in the United States with an economy that's going to collapse, or we can take a stab at the government and we can really do some carving there. And if we do that carving, whittle the government down, we can not only balance the budget, but we can have a budget surplus. We could even eliminate the personal income tax if we get serious about carving away all the fat in the government.
Well, that, you know what? I've always said that that would be a boon to the economy. People would have their money, you know, less whatever we put in, let's say, to Social Security and maybe Medicare, that would stay and things like that. But if you had most of your income, I think people would spend a lot of it, don't you?
Well, absolutely. You know, George, we've got a national debt, $14.5 trillion. We have unfunded liabilities for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security of $61 trillion. This year's deficit, $1.27 trillion. Debt by 2019 will be $25 trillion by most estimates. And, you know, this doesn't have to be. We have total revenues for this year, $2.57 trillion, total expenditures of $3.83 trillion. If we just carved off over $1 trillion, we could balance the budget. And it's possible to cut out some very significant spending and actually produce a $500 billion budget surplus and balance the budget and then pay down the debt. We could also eliminate the personal income tax. I've got a detailed listing of agencies and departments that can be eliminated. If you eliminated the Department of Labor, Department of Transportation, Department of Education, Department of Commerce, Department of Energy, and replace most manned fighters and bombers with unmanned aerial systems, you could save a total from all of that of $380 billion.
Wow.
And if you took out NASA, privatized aspects of the Food and Drug Administration, eliminated the Drug Enforcement Administration, Small Business Administration, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the EEOC, Federal Communications Commission, by privatizing the airwaves, National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, Environmental Protection Agency programs that are excessive, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the new bureau, entirely eliminate that, Consumer Product Safety Commission, eliminate it, and Federal Trade Commission, that'd be $8.3 billion more. And if you end U.S. involvement in Libya, Iraq, and Afghanistan, $150 billion savings, repeal Obamacare, the stimulus bill, jobs bill, bailout bills, $1.5 trillion. Limit Social Security and Medicare just to those who need it and offer an opt-out for others. with a payback, and then have a private system of paying tax credits to businesses to pay the cost of medical and welfare needs of people. That'd be $500 billion. Eliminate Troubled Asset Relief Fund, welfare for the rich, $11 billion. Eliminate Federal Jobs Initiatives, $25 billion saved. Declare a moratorium.
You've got this whole budget down to a science, Jonathan.
I've got it down. I'll tell you, that could save $2.39 trillion. So when all is said and done, George, when all is said and done, we could have American greatness back and eliminate the personal income tax and still have a surplus. We could have $2.78 trillion cut, budget surplus of $1.5 trillion. We can eliminate the individual income tax, reducing revenue by $1.1 trillion, and still have a surplus of $400 billion. And then,
which is amazing. It's not that difficult to balance the budget.
It takes guts.
That's it. That's it. And then, you know, over time, you know, nobody's saying we can or will or should retire the debt immediately. That's got to be done over a very long time. But let's balance the budget and start whittling down the debt. I think our AAA rating will go back up with S&P. And you know what? It'll be a better place to live.
It would. We can have a free market. We can have a country where people who do criminal things and evil things are prosecuted. But this whole bureaucracy, we've created a bureaucratic state that is so expensive. And not only is it costly in terms of these outlays of expenditures, but it also so restricts freedom of choice in the marketplace. We're going to talk about that in the raw food market.
Yeah.
So restricts freedom of choice in the marketplace that it is crippling this nation.
What I want to do with you this hour, Jonathan, is talk with you about rights, about the FDA. Next hour, we'll spend some time talking about this FDA raid with you and the two consumer leaders who are going to be joining us to talk about this bizarre situation, why the FDA says they need to do this, and why you and the other leaders say, no, we don't. But let's talk, first of all, about the FDA, because there are some people out there who will say, come on, don't we need a watchdog, somebody to protect us, someone to order recalls, someone to shut down some of these pharmaceutical companies or yank these drugs? How do you answer that?
Well, the sad reality is that outside of law enforcement, you know, we have local health and safety officials who do a very good job oftentimes in protecting people from contamination. As far as drugs go, we're virtually defenseless, as David Graham, FDA Associate Director of the Office of Drug Safety, has actually said. He said that we're virtually defenseless. The FDA is a captive of the drug industry. And his whistleblowing, quite courageous, led to some pretty extraordinary revelations from within the agency, from others who said unsafe drugs are approved. The point is, the FDA is corrupt, a very corrupt institution. I think it's incapable of being transformed into something positive. We have to eliminate it and replace it, I think, with a statutory system whereby drug reviews for safety and efficacy are performed in a blinded manner at universities in an academic environment, free of all of the politics and the money and the and the corruption that exists there in Washington.
No funding from these pharmaceutical companies that go directly to the schools, I trust. But
well,
they should put it in
a
kitty. Why? You know, I see nothing wrong with all pharmaceutical companies putting a block of money into some group that is nonpartisan here, that then divvies it out and doesn't even tell anybody where it comes from. What do you think of that?
That's perfect. That's exactly precisely a description of the program that I've recommended, where drug companies would pay a fee for the review of their drugs in a blinded manner to the Department of Justice. It would go to the Department of Justice. Justice would have a large kitty. It would all be blinded. You wouldn't know who had paid the money into the system.
Right.
Their applications for drug approval would be blinded, would be sent off to the universities. You know, people don't understand. FDA does no testing of any drug that's introduced in the market. They rely entirely on the drug company applicant to do the testing and report it accurately.
And then they accept it based as fact.
Right. And they assume, unless the drug company raises issues about the safety of its own drug, that the drug is safe. This is outrageous. I mean, the system is so corrupt and beholden to the drug industry, even from the description of how this works, you see that the drug industry is calling all the shots. We need to have a system that goes to the universities where the drug agent is identified, it's actually tested in clinical trials, all of this done in secret, They produce their reports on whether a drug is safe and efficacious, and then those reports have the authority of law. And if a drug company disagrees with the result, it can sue and have a federal court review it. But the result should be not that they get the drug on the market, but that they get a second shot at having another independent university review without their knowledge. So it has to be a system that is based on science, not on politics. The current system is based on politics. These people who are in political appointees within the FDA get out of the FDA and then go to work for the pharmaceutical industry, either directly on their boards of directors or funded in their through lobbying groups in Washington, like what happened to FDA Commissioner Lester Crawford, who's at Policy Directions, Inc. It's funded in part by Merck. Merck, he helped well at the FDA. I mean, this is the kind of thing that goes on with such regularity that it reveals just how corrupt this system is. The American people deserve better, and they can have it, and they can have it at a lot less public expense, too.
Well, there's no doubt about that. We saw what happened with aspartame and the FDA.
Yes, it's the same old story. Aspartame, GMOs. Look at Avandia, the drug, the type 2 diabetes drug. I mean, even in the presence of enormous scientific evidence, peer-reviewed publications in JAMA and in The Lancet that Avandia increases the risk of heart attack substantially. And even upon the FDA's own review panel saying that Avandia had created heart toxicity, the FDA commissioner keeps it on the market for those who are taking it, restricts it for future use for those who would be newly prescribed. But for those who are taking it, she keeps it on the market for them. Outrageous. Those people are the greatest risk of a heart attack, those who've taken it the longest, and yet she keeps it on the market for them. Why? Because the financial interests of the maker of Avandia are more important in the end than the lives of those who are on the drug. This story is repeated over and over again. There's so many drugs on the market that the FDA's own medical reviewers have said are unsafe, and yet, you know, we are the guinea pigs out here, and we're the ones who are suffering. The physicians don't even have consciousness about this in general. Most of them prescribe these drugs like they did with Vioxx, completely oblivious to the fact that these things are agents of death sometimes. And in fact, some of these drugs, like Cerevent is a drug for asthma. It increases the risk of death from asthma by several times. Or you take commonly prescribed drugs like the statin drugs. The statin drugs reduce the endogenous production of coenzyme Q10 through a thing called the malevinate pathway into the bloodstream. That pathway is blocked in order to block cholesterol from getting into the bloodstream, but at the same time it blocks that, it also blocks the introduction of an essential ATP starter, coenzyme Q10. So it causes necessarily myopathy. Ultimately, it can cause myopathy of all the major muscle groups, including the heart. So here you have a drug that's supposed to reduce your risk of a heart attack, and it actually can increase your risk of heart failure.
And you know, the poor unsuspecting person at home, he or she doesn't know. They just go by what the doctor prescribes, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, many commonly prescribed drugs are very dangerous substances. You take the bisphosphonates. These are the things like Boniva and Actonel, drugs that are for osteoporosis or osteopenia. Well, these drugs reduce their osteoclasts and osteoblasts. Osteoclasts, I hope I have this right, osteoclasts tear down, I think, the bone, while osteoclasts build the bone. And this process of tearing down and building bone, which goes on simultaneously all the time, is essential for your bones to be elastic, so you can jump up and down without having your bones be so rigid as to break. Well, what the drug companies did with the bisphosphonates is create drugs that eliminate the bone tearing down mechanism and preserve the bone mineralization mechanism or building mechanism. Well, you would think that would be good, except for the fact that it causes mineralization on the exterior part of the bone, makes the scans look good, but ends up actually increasing the brittleness of bone. So the drugs that are prescribed for the purpose of reducing fracture can actually increase your risk of fracture by many times.
Jonathan, let me ask you, if there's a salmonella scare coming from some farm, some produce place, somewhere, who cracks down on them? Is it the FDA or the USDA?
It's frequently the USDA and it's frequently the local health and safety people. When it's a serious problem, you oftentimes don't have the FDA there. That's the real irony here.
Huh. All right. Now, the FDA itself, is there anything they do that you would say is not bad?
I'm afraid everything that the FDA does is heavily tainted with politics. You see, every decision made by the FDA is ultimately made by the FDA commissioners, a political appointee, and the determination of whether to do something is a political decision. I remember one time I came from in a case in Nevada where I had a legal determination that a party was contaminating, was selling contaminated products and actually resulted in injury to people, including deaths. And I took an order from a court which allowed me to take the information to the FDA. And I took that information, it's a court order, went to the FDA, went to the chief counsel's office, gave them the material, and said, here, look, this is a company that ought to be shut down. And what did the FDA do with it? Absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
And I remember talking to a former FDA chief counsel, and I said, my goodness, I gave this information to the FDA. People were actually dying out there. The suit actually did such damage to the company when we prevailed that it ultimately caused the company to be downsized substantially. But the point is, it was time to go after these bad actors. And here it was, they didn't do it. I said, well, why is this? And he said, Jonathan, it's not enough that you bring in bodies to the FDA. You've got to get 60 minutes on it.
Yeah.
The point is, politics reigns at that agency like nowhere else, and that's the root of this problem. When you can make a judgment, it's an evil call, that a drug that could hurt people, when there are substitutes for it that are already in the market that don't, should go on the market because the financial interests of the drug companies are great. You are it's a bargain with the devil. You and I both know, I've described this at length in my book, The Rise of Tyranny, and my book, Global Censorship of Health Information, how this system is so corrupt and evil and causes all of these things. And I just, it is so bad, so pervasive, it is very hard for me to identify a single instance where FDA was not, even in a good circumstance, a Johnny-come-lately, rather than doing its job. If the agency protected the public health, we wouldn't have some 200,000 deaths a year from FDA-approved drugs when they're properly prescribed.
Is it up that high now? 200,000?
There are different estimates. Some are around 100,000. Some are up to 200,000. Where it is exactly, I don't know. But 100,000 is enough. 200,000 is enough. This is too much.
Crazy.
This is, we shouldn't have a country where it has become so drug-dependent for a solution for every health problem. It's pharmacological. That people are drawn into a system and ultimately can die from that very system.
What percent of the people out there, Jonathan, do you think are taking some kind of pharmaceutical drug, some prescription, something for something, whether it's a cholesterol pill, blood pressure, heart, whatever, what percent? I would say it's about 60 to 70% out there at once you get into certain age brackets.
Well, I think you're right. I think when you take into account the psychoactive drugs like Ritalin and the overprescription of those drugs and the ruination of an entire generation of young people, when you have young people lining up in front of the nurse's station inside a public school for their daily fix with these psychoactive drugs, I mean, it's not just certainly the elderly, yes. Almost every person who is 65 or older is on some pharmacological agent for the rest of their lives. But when you take young people and they're on these drugs habitually, and these drugs alter the biochemistry of their brains, I mean, we are doping the American public with a system that is reinforced by a very strong government push into the medical community that says your first and foremost remedy in every circumstance is a pharmacological agent.
Jonathan, we're going to take this break, come back and talk more. I want to ask you how these young people are getting prescription drugs that they're taking to put themselves into a different state of mind. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll talk about the FDA raiding some food co-ops. What's that all about? And also, next hour after that, we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, are you a Coast Insider? Well, you can be, participating in video chats, downloads, podcasting, and Coast to Coast mobile apps. Just simply go to coasttocoastam.com, and for less than 25 cents a day, you could become a Coast Insider. And welcome back to Coast, Jonathan Emord with us this hour. He'll be with us for the full program. Jonathan, in schools right now, the craze popping Xanax pills, Xanax prescribed for panic attacks and ailments like that. Where in the heck are these kids getting these prescription drugs? Doctors have to sign for it. Are they stealing it from their parents? Is somebody getting a prescription from a doctor and selling them? Where are they getting it?
Well, these drugs, these psychoactive drugs, which are largely ineffectual, unfortunately, they're largely ineffectual and they're commonly prescribed. There's a whole universe of drugs that have come into the market as psychoactive altering drugs. And those drugs oftentimes are no more effective than placebo. But these drugs are very popular because of their mind-altering effects. And, of course, kids will have an interest in it. Parents are prescribed those drugs. Xanax is very commonly prescribed a psychological agent. It's overprescribed. As a consequence, many people get those drugs just by going into the doctor and saying that they have a panic disorder. They get the prescription. So people can go in, get prescriptions, not even use them, resell them in the black market. Kids can get them from their, take it out of the medicine cabinet for their parents. Kids can be prescribed the drugs directly themselves based on representing to a psychiatrist or psychologist that they have a panic disorder. It's just insane. These things are so overprescribed, and it's a big money maker. And, the drug companies that are making these things and selling them are not oblivious to the fact that it's happening.
I was going to say, they know what's going on, don't they?
Sure. They know very well. They have a process called detailing where they work with physicians and also with pharmacies and able to determine the volume of these drugs that are moving in any location of the country. They know that the drugs are moving in such a large volume in certain areas of the country that it's not justified. And that is entirely in excess of what could reasonably be determined to be appropriate. But they're delighted to see the profits come in, and they do nothing to stop it.
That's frightening, frightening. And it's happening all over the country and in younger and younger age brackets.
And, you know, the position taken by the FDA and by the drug industry is that these drugs are not addictive. And yet Paxil, Effexor, Zoloft, and Ritalin, and Xanax, all of these things, of course, can be addictive. I mean, virtually any drug that has an altering effect upon the brain can be addictive. And people are experiencing these addictions. There are entire clinics that have been established to wean kids now in their 20s and 30s off of these drugs after a lifetime, a generation of being addicted to them. They're also prescribing these things to kids in grade school. I mean, all
Jeez.
The way down to 4 and 5 year old kids are being prescribed these sorts of drugs. It is an abusive, horrific environment where our children are being dumbed down to a common denominator. And, you know, it is okay to have a hyperactive kid as long as the hyperactivity doesn't prevent the kid from functioning. It's a miraculous thing to have a child that is curious about the world, so curious that his mind leads him to look out the window when he's supposed to be studying. I mean, we're all built differently, and we all have different interests, but we would hope that the environment wouldn't be a straitjacket where kids are led to believe that if they don't sit and are comatose, that they can't get an education. Sure, there are troublemaking kids in education. Sure, there's a need for greater discipline there. But my point is, you don't substitute drugs for discipline. And that's what we've got. We've got a lot of the teachers in the education system who are fed up with having to deal with the fact that they can't appropriately exclude kids from the classroom who are so disruptive, find it a huge relief when those kids are then put on drugs.
Jonathan, what does a parent do if they suspect their kid's taking something like Xanax, or what are the symptoms? How do they know? Groggy?
Well, it may be a subtle difference in behavior. The problem is that a lot of this stuff is difficult to perceive, and parents who do not have a very close relationship with their kids and really know their friends and know what they do will find it rather hard to figure out. Even ones who do will find it hard to figure it out. It's extremely difficult. I mean, we have a culture, but based on the media that constantly bombards us with advertising about drugs, based on the pushing of drugs by physicians, based on the presence of drugs in every aspect of our lives, it is very difficult to get kids to think of drugs as things that should be taken at a last resort or that should be restricted in their use. And as a consequence, we shouldn't be surprised that we have a society where drugs are viewed not as something that is necessary for the treatment of disease necessarily, but are convenience drugs. I mean, the whole notion of all of the, and I don't mean to disparage these drugs because they have a definite purpose, but it's the mindset that's created by drugs like, you know, the drugs that are for erectile dysfunction that cause a lot of people to think of drugs in a different way, as sort of a convenience or a helpmate. I mean, many people do have erectile dysfunction who might need those drugs. There are a lot of people using those drugs as a recreational tool, and that's the kind of mindset that the drug industry really looks to in the future of a lot of drugs.
How many people do you think are dying using these things recreationally, stupidly? And we don't hear about these deaths, of course, but how many people do you think might be dying, Jonathan, across this country, across Canada?
I don't know. I do know that there's some 100,000 to 200,000 people who are dying from prescription drugs taken according to the prescription. But the number, as you point out, I mean, it's very hard to get accurate data on the number of people who are dying from drugs who are using them in this sort of recreational way, because many of the symptoms that are triggered are symptoms that you might find from ordinary life of a person: heart attack, stroke, various forms of psychosis, and without some pathology, without actually dissecting the body, taking the blood, having it analyzed, and determining whether these agents are in your body, which is done with only a small fraction of people who die. It's hard to tell. So a lot of people undoubtedly are succumbing to these things and experiencing psychoses that are taken to be a result of some inherent mental defect that are actually a byproduct of the abuse of these agents at some point in their lives.
This is an amazing story, Jonathan. This is huge. Yet it's not getting the attention it needs, is it?
Well, it isn't. I've written these books, you know, The Rise of Tyranny. It's available through Amazon.com, where I explain how this whole thing came to be. I talk specifically about these psychoactive drugs and how even within the FDA, the FDA's own medical reviewer on this point was assigned the task of determining, this is many, many years ago, assigned the task of determining whether these drugs would increase the risk of suicidality in kids. And they thought for sure, because he was one of the ones who favored the introduction of these drugs, that he would come to the conclusion that the drugs were fine, were safe. Unbeknownst to them, he was undergoing a change of heart on this point because of the science, and he came to the conclusion after a thorough review of the science that these drugs would actually increase the risk of suicide. These are the serotonin reuptake inhibitor
right.
drugs. And he wrote a scientific analysis of this and gave it to his supervisors, and they promptly suppressed it and punished him for his review, demanded that he redo it so that it would find the opposite. He refused to do that, and he became a pariah within the FDA. Then later on, the British health authorities found the same information. It was published in the peer-reviewed literature, and the British health authorities banned these substances for prescription to kids. Here in the United States, no, still available to kids. Finally, after decades, the FDA put a black box warning on there that said that it might increase your risk of suicide. But did it affect the availability of these things to kids? No.
No. What about fluoride?
Well, fluoride's a very interesting thing. Of course, fluoride has a therapeutic history that goes with it that establishes that fluoride can help reduce dental caries. But there's this very dark and negative side to it, which is that it can increase cancer and it can increase various other cancer-related type ailments. And so fluoridation of the water supply, which is mandatory in many jurisdictions around the United States, is outrageous, just as is mandatory fortification of foods by the FDA. I mean, it's nice to have something that is an agent that might help, but when you make everybody take it, you're going to force people with allergic reactions to it who already have sufficient quantitative amounts of it in their system to get excessive amounts of it, and those that may be at risk of cancer to have that triggered. So this notion, this big government, paternalistic government notion so common today, that the government ought to make everybody do something when they finally decide it by saying, okay, let's put iron filings in all cereal. You know, if you're going to say your cereal is fortified with any vitamin or mineral, you have to also have iron in this quantitative amount. And the preferable method of doing it is to chop up metal filings and throw that in there. Well, that type of mentality, which iron increases the risk of cancer, too.
Oh, that's true.
It's just outrageous. You know, it's outrageous. And it denies people freedom of choice. It decides for them and forces them to do it. I'm the biggest fan of, for example, folic acid. I think, you know, reduces the risk of neural tube defects. Every woman of childbearing age, before she becomes pregnant, should be taking it. She can reduce her risk if she takes 400 micrograms a day to 800 micrograms a day by 40 to 80% of having a neural tube defect birth. It can reduce that risk. It's profound and wonderful. But I'm not a fan of putting it, if mandatory fortification that exists from the FDA, in all foods that are called fortified, so that all bread, farina, other foods have to have this in it. And you know, we need the freedom of choice here, and men don't need to have this constantly, perhaps. Maybe they do, but the science is debatable. Some people may be getting enough from their diet. Some people may be taking supplements and getting ample amounts of it. Why do we need to be dictated that you know, all of our food has to have a certain quantity of these things in it, when in fact some people may not need it? We need to be educated about it and educated about fluoride, and if you have a significant history of dental caries, perhaps you should have fluoride. But for the rest of us, we shouldn't have to drink fluoride every day.
No, and it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. If you're fortunate enough to live on a well, you might avoid that. But if you're in a municipality, you're drinking fluoride.
Well, and if you cook a lot with it, you're drinking fluoride. It's everywhere. And if you take a shower, isn't it coming through your skin?
It's certainly coming through your skin. And you know, it's there are also all of these chlorine-based substances that they pour into the water, and this also increases toxicity. Chloride and chlorine have adverse effects upon the body. They're highly toxic substances. So we do things. The public health system in the country, the whole system that says every kid has to be vaccinated with, you know, 50 billion vaccines, and this paternalistic and very aggressive public health mentality is damaging our health. It ends up being something that is really sacrificing our liberty and our health. In the case of vaccines, for example, it ought to be an individual choice, and it should be a circumstance where the government has less restrictive alternatives than forcing you to be tied down and be injected with an agent that you don't want. The solution to the problem of vaccination is rather simple and profound. Diseases, communicable diseases, are ones that individuals become susceptible to in almost every instance because of interpersonal contact. And if you minimize the interpersonal contact and you have people wash their hands and you have them cover their mouths when they sneeze or cough, and you have them stay out of school when they get a cold, and you rigorously enforce these policies, you and sanitation, most importantly, constantly clean the environment, as they learned in hospitals, reducing the disease by 40% communicable disease in hospitals simply by insisting that doctors and nurses wash their hands. I mean, these things reduce the communication of these diseases and make the incidence of a true epidemic almost unheard of.
I've got a friend of mine I used to laugh at her who will not touch the railing of an escalator because she says, you have no idea how many germs are on these things. And she won't do it.
Well, she's being very cautious. I mean, if you're in an airplane and you have that little thing above your head where the air comes blasting through the vents,
right?
That circulated air is some of the most polluted with bacteria and viruses in the world.
I don't catch a lot of colds, Jonathan, but when I do, it's because I've flown on a plane all the time. I mean, I won't get a cold during the normal season, nothing, unless I've been on a plane, and then about 2 or 3 days later, it hits me.
Well, I'm with you, brother. I just flew back from Utah, and I followed the advice of Dr. Charles Simone, who I love dearly, oncologist and immunologist, and I turned that thing off above my head, but I can't dictate the choice of the people on my right and my left.
Well, and it's on the whole plane.
It is. But when it's blowing right in your face, and you know, I get back here, and I'd had a long cold, and now I'm over that cold, but now I feel that little tingling sensation in my chest again.
Just hanging on. I've seen some people sit on planes, and they'll put these little cough masks on. You know, initially, they don't want you walking onto the plane with this, you know, because of Homeland Security and everything. But I've seen people put them on planes.
Well, it's not a bad idea. A lot of people are doing that just, you know, day-to-day walking around with those things on. And you can't blame them. I mean, particularly when we're in flu season and it's common. I mean, I walked into a store one time, and as I was walking in, this person was walking out, and all of a sudden he sneezed right in my face. And I got the worst cold, I think, respiratory ailment I've ever had in my life. You know, I thought, my goodness, what an easy form of terrorism that is. And he just blasted me with a cold.
Well, my classic story, years and years ago, a friend of mine, we were meeting some people on a business deal. And the people hadn't shown up yet at the restaurant. So, you know, he and I were in the bar talking, and he sneezes. And he sneezes as he cuffs his two hands around his nose, right? He goes, achoo! And he's right in there, blows right into his hands. The people just came inside the restaurant, introduced themselves, and he shakes their hand.
Ah.
And I'm watching this, John. I'm just cringing, and it was just horrible. It was just horrible. You know, I'm saying to myself, the guy could have excused himself, gone to the restroom, washed his hands, whatever, but it was just unbelievable. It really was. Anyway, let me ask you very quickly before the break, and then we're going to bring in Corrine and Lori next hour. Genetically modified foods. Have you gone into any legalese about this?
Well, unfortunately, the writing is long on the wall on this one, and the FDA is allowing these things into the marketplace with wild abandon. About 75% of vegetables in the grocery store are genetically modified. And FDA took the rather scary position recently in a rulemaking on genetically modified foods that it would not allow substances in the market to be labeled, affirmatively labeled, as having genetically modified ingredients among the arguments, this one, that you really can't find any organic product that does not contain genetically modified agents in it because of the enormous diffusion of genetically modified crops in the market. In other words, because GMO plants are so commonly grown in mass agriculture across the United States, even organic farms cannot prevent pollution from the pollen running into their farms from these GMO farms.
No, so, and hence, though, didn't some farmers just win against Monsanto?
Yes,
yep.
And I had argued for that. Unfortunately, I wasn't the lawyer for them. I would have loved that, but I've argued for that for some time. The people ought to be arguing, you know, Monsanto was arguing, suing farmers, organic farmers, saying that when there was a GMO crop in their field, that they were violating their patent.
Even though it blew in,
right,
or was dropped in by a bee or something.
And these GMO, these organic producers, I was saying, my goodness, your argument ought to be trespass, that you have a right to grow your organic crops on your farm.
That's
and that
right.
Their wayward pollen and wayward seeds are polluting your farm and are, you know, causing this to trespass. But anyway, I'm glad to hear that. And I think, unfortunately for us all, we're going to find out whether or not GMOs actually alter our gastrointestinal system and cause cancer and so on within the decade, we having been unwitting guinea pigs.
It may be too long away. Jonathan, when we come back, we'll talk about the FDA raiding the California Food Co-op and also coming down on a farmer in Pennsylvania as well. Lots to talk about on Coast to Coast AM.